That was Elsie Carlisle with Kiss Me Goodnight, Sergeant Major. You're listening to Radio Wivenhoe and a special programme about Ethan Engel's latest play, Private Resistance, which comes to the William Lovelace Hall on the 17th and 18th of February. We just heard from Matt Addis, who plays Tom. Matt mentioned Coles Hill, the auxiliary training base near Highworth in Swindon. The Coles Hill House website at www.coleshillhouse.com is now home to the Coles Hill Auxiliary Research Team, and it provides a comprehensive online resource about the units, and it's something that's well worth checking out. Each of the units had a secret underground hideout, known officially as the Operational Base, or OB. They were constructed in isolated or unusual places, usually in a good observation position. Early OBs were quite rudimentary, but later versions were built with improved air ventilation. As part of the research for the play, the cast visited a recreated OB at Parham Airfield. When I caught up with Phil Pritchard, I started by asking about that visit.
Parham Airfield has a small museum attached to it. It's a specific museum that's been created to really mark the work of what were called the auxiliary units. When we got there, we found that they mocked up and built an auxiliary operational base, as they were called, or OB, which is effectively an underground bunker. And the purpose of the bunkers was, in the event of an invasion in the Second World War, that operational units or auxiliary units would go underground and attack German forces from behind the lines and create havoc. And this was Winston Churchill's personal idea. And when we got to the air base just before they took us down into the bunker, we had a talk from a very fascinating man called Richard Shipley, who was an armourer in the army for many years and is an expert on the kind of weapons that the auxiliary units were issued with. And he showed us all manner of weapons, including Tommy guns, which were imported from America. Incredibly, we imported half a million Tommy guns from the Americans, and only 90,000 made it to Britain because the rest were sunk in U-boat attacks. But those 90,000 Tommy guns weren't given to the regular army or the Home Guard. They were given to the auxiliary units. So they were very privileged and lucky to be prioritised for weapons.
And the character you play, Frank,
yes,
is one of the auxiliary unit members.
Yes.
How would he have coped with the kind of conditions that you were seeing in the OB unit at Parham?
Well, Frank, in the play, is recruited specifically because he has experience of the First World War. He's a veteran of that, and he's also a gamekeeper and a local man. And the instructions for people who were to recruit the patrols was that they should be local people who could get about in the dark. In other words, who knew the land very well. And Frank is recruited as the patrol leader. So I think he felt that, oh, I certainly feel in the play that he would have coped with it very well. They were given 10 days to 2 weeks. They, you know, in the event of an invasion, they were told you've got to stay down there for 10 days or 2 weeks and attack the enemy. In the play, they last for about 6 weeks and managed to bomb all kind of things. So, yeah, he's quite well suited to it. And because he's fought already, he knows what to expect in terms of the warfare. But still, I mean, when we went down there, there's very confined space. You've got bunks for six people. You've also got a very narrow passageway where all the explosives are stored. And dynamite is very vulnerable. You know, if you make a loud noise, it can go off and so on.
All the explosives we were issued with. I should think I had... Well, I can tell you roughly what I had. In the dump up there, I had 4 10-gallon milk churns full of explosives because they went rotten. And after the time ran out, and when we went to look, the sticky bombs, the nitroglycerin, the sticky bombs had run through the hand hinges.
Really?
Yeah. And you'd only got to get like that to one, you see, and it opened it. It would have blown.
Really?
Yeah. Because the slightest friction on the nitroglycerin will send it. Well, we had to leave it. I'd get the army to come in and move it for us.
Yeah.
They cleaned the whole row of houses out and put them back.
Yeah.
And that was a place where people used to go pigeon shooting, or if you went courting, you'd always go. It was like a beautiful spot. Just in the corner of Hawkwood. And then we had another big one down in the hall where we had our axle. what we call our OB, our operational base. Mm-hmm. That Steins of Rat was still there. Well, that was big enough for 6 hours to sleep, and we could have gone down there for several days if we wanted to.
How deep was it underground?
The bottom of the gravel pit, we were just above the water level, and then we had a heap, a great big heap on top. Mm-hmm. How we did it, the military were doing the defences, and we got friendly with the driver of the Ruston Bucyrus.
The what?
Ruston Bucyrus.
What's that?
That's a huge one-ton digger.
Oh, I see.
The Jagline.
Yeah.
We got friendly with him, always to help him out and give him his tea and so forth. And then I found he reacted very well to a pair of rabbits. with the result, one weekend he left his keys. That's when we built our dugout. Because two of us were quite capable of driving a digger. We had this thing out. Just prayed it wasn't going to break or do something while we were headed out. We took it round into the place and we dug the pit out. One weekend, then we put the concreted the inside.
Oh, you concreted it inside?
Yes, yeah. We had elephant iron.
Sorry?
Elephant iron. What's that? This very heavy gauge corrugated stuff.
Oh, yes.
Which they made air raid shelters of.
Ah, yeah.
So we acquired some of that.
How did you acquire it?
Well, we got that again through the military, a little barter system.
What did you barter for it?
Oh, food.
Yeah.
You know, rabbit, pheasant, breast pheasants, that sort of thing. Yeah. Oh, that was the only thing that's worth money then.
Yes.
So we traded everything. We got the elephant iron, we bolted it and fixed it during the week, and then we borrowed the digger the next week and covered it all over.
Yeah.
Oh, it was a huge concern. I mean, half as big as this one.
Mm. Oh, I see.
Oh, yes, I mean. See, I think we moved, we must have moved in the 100 ton stuff.
Yeah.
To do it.
Yes.
We had an elaborate setup, and you couldn't get. The only way of getting to it was down through the centre of an old holly tree.
Oh, I see.
We entered it back there. So there was paths going past it. You know, we kept paths all through it. We used the farm path. We used to drive the tractor past it.
Yeah.
We used to drive the cows past it. So that there was coming and going.
Yeah.
There was nothing new.
Yeah.
So if you had gone through there, you could have walked right down the path where people ordinarily walk. And he was all very good.
Yeah.
That's how we worked it out. That was the mental approach to it.
Having heard all about the observational bases, I think it's time we focus now on the women in the story of private resistance. But before we do, it's time for that special recording that I mentioned at the top of the programme. This next track was recorded especially for us by After Hours, a new jazz duo featuring Roehedge bass guitarist Simon Hurley and Wivenhoe bass vocalist Fee Mason. How High the Moon itself first featured in the 1940s Broadway review, Two for the Show. The song was sung in a slow foxtrot tempo, and each night the performance would end with the cast looking at the sky, cowering, obviously terrified. A clear night meant Bomber's Moon. Thank you. as with How High the Moon, recorded especially for this programme by Simon Hurley and Fee Mason. Frances Marshall comes to Eastern Angles having played a series of, in her own words, dumb blondes and young children. She spent 2 years playing Phyllis in the recent production The Railway Children, for example, so WVS volunteer Diane is something completely different. I started by asking Fran about the difficult position that Diane finds herself in.
I think she's in a very interesting position because of those people who are dependent on her, or who at least she feels responsible for. So because she loves people, principally her nephew, Wilf, I think that therefore means she has a lot more questions to ask. She can't just commit to out-and-out resistance because people will get hurt. It's not just family, there's also people in the town. There's the idea of people moving, refugees, people not being in the town that they belong in, so they need the help of the WVS, which Diane is a member of, or is a volunteer for, and therefore there's a lot of people who need her. And I think because of that, that makes her question what she can do and what the best course is. Is it actually better to just wait and see, to just sit down and let things happen in order to save the people that you love?
There's that really interesting thing running almost all the way through the play about the auxiliary unit being this very secret movement that
yes.
even wives, girlfriends aren't meant to know about.
Because I don't know about it at all.
But there's also this kind of, particularly in your relationship with Wilf, there's the,
yes.
it's a pseudo-mother maternal relationship.
Yes.
There's that sense of how much does she realise in terms of what Wilf's getting up to and what he's getting himself involved in.
Yeah, and he goes away as well and grows up quite a bit and certainly grows up just in what he's having to deal with, probably more than your average 15-year-old, I think, would have to deal with. She wants to be a mother, I think, but she isn't one. Her husband's in a prison of war camp, so that's not going to happen for a while. So I think she feels like that about Wilf, and she feels really protective over him, and yet here's this person that's suddenly grown up and is almost taking charge.
One of the things that's clear about the process so far has been the amount of detail in terms of kind of the historical stories
yes.
leading up to this. And I was wondering kind of what you've been finding out in terms of the auxiliary units and in terms of this production, also perhaps the role of women in the Second World War.
Yeah, I think women changed hugely in the Second World War. I mean, they changed in both wars. And I think the result, well, not direct, but indirect result of the Second World War was that they got the vote. And the Second World War, they were almost ready for what they had to do. I was reading, so Ivan, the writer, gave me a book, which I started reading very recently. It's written by Marjorie Allingham, and it concerns somebody who was sort of jumping up immediately. They all had to help. Like something happens in 1938, and suddenly the whole village has to come together. They don't even know that war's going to happen, but they have a responsibility to do certain things. So she's trying gas masks on people and sort of recruiting people in a way. And I think women, because of this work, because the responsibility was on them, they had to suddenly take charge, and they had to actually do work, they had to actually make decisions, they had to cope without the men, and they found this freedom and this strength that they didn't necessarily know they had. And one interesting thing that she says particularly is that they've almost been ready for this because the slightly older generation, so if we think that Diane, my character, is in her early 30s during the course of the play, then people sort of 10 years older than her, the people she would look up to, may have perished in World War One. So actually there's almost a feeling of being ready to step up to this challenge that they've got to step up to. And certainly, you know, reading accounts of women who joined the WVS or signed up, they certainly had... women had to do so much alone. I think that was one thing I was told that was really intriguing, was that whereas the men were with their troops, and even the auxiliary units would have six or... you know, there'd be five or six of them in a little gang, the women could be sitting in a bunker somewhere on their own in the dark with a radio and... a gun, as somebody said, and possibly a cyanide tablet as well. So they're on their own in the dark, having to do something very risky, carrying messages, leaving notes, but alone. And that's a bit, that's
quite
terrifying.
A chilling thought, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
One of the things that you were telling me about earlier on was how to think about a track of music for it.
Yes, I have.
Go on, tell us about it.
Well, I think I really love a song from Showboat, which is called Make Believe. The first version of film of Showboat was in 1936. So it's sung by Alan Jones. The idea is that these two people really love each other, but they're making believe that they love. It's a sort of flirting, I suppose. Let's make believe we're in love. And I think that I just had this idea that perhaps with your husband so far away, that that's what you're having to do. Just make believe that I love you, make believe you love me. I had this over-romantic idea that perhaps Diana Mike, her husband, might have put it on the night before he went away or something like that. He's given it to her and she plays it.
Let's have a listen.
The game of just supposing is the sweetest game I know. Our dreams are more romantic than the world we see. And if the things we dream about don't happen to be so, that's just an unimportant technicality. 'Cause we could make believe, oh, I love you. We could make believe that you love me. Others find peace of mind in pretending. Couldn't you, couldn't I, couldn't we make believe our lips are blending in a phantom kiss or two or three? Might as well. I pray 'twas too much to say the words that betray my heart. I only pretend I do not offend in playing a lover's part.
That was Make Believe from Oklahoma, the track that Diane and her husband just might have danced to the night before he went away to war. Throughout the programme, we've also been hearing some of the soundscape being specially created for Private Resistance by Ely-based musician and composer Chris Warner. You can find out more about Chris at his website www.chriswarnermusic.com. In building up a picture of the lives of their characters, it's not just Parham the company have visited. Last Saturday, they took a field trip to Manningtree and Harwich, where the play is set. Here's actor Phil Pritchard again.
So we had a brilliant trip to Manningtree at the weekend, and kindly the Manningtree Museum keeper agreed to stay over after their opening time and give us a quick talk and showed us some aerial photographs taken by the Luftwaffe of Manningtree in 1939, which gave us an exact layout. And thankfully, everything in the play corresponds to the layout of the photographs. So we've all had a good grounding in that. And there's a lot about place in the play. You know, we talk about the Maltings, for example, the Manning Tree Triangle, which is where the railway splits from the sort of Norwich to London line over to Harwich. And that's key in the play in terms of the last act when we actually rise up against the Nazis. So yeah, we've been lucky with our research. We've had some good guidance.
I'm now joined by Bishanya, who's playing Prue. Tell us a little bit about Prue.
Prue. Prue is a delightful young woman, slightly saucy, and kind of a bit of a bull in a china shop, if I'm honest. She kind of speaks without thinking. There's a real freedom about her, which is quite unusual in the sense of, you know, the Nazis have invaded and everyone around that time period is still kind of really upright in society. So she's slightly different and a little bit off the beaten track, and she really enjoys kind of teasing and manipulating those around her, which is fun. She's from Colchester. She's definitely an outsider in terms of the community of Manningtree, where it's set. It's a very small place. And she's been billeted there as an ATS soldier, as it were. And she's kind of come and at a time when, you know, Britain's in the throes of kind of losing its freedom. And she kind of brings this optimism and persistence to gain back their freedom, which is something that, you know, during the time, a lot of people, you know, they lose that will to kind of fight. And I think during the play, she doesn't lose that, which is something that's really heartening.
Tell us where you are in the rehearsal process.
It's really kind of discovering the characters and how they relate to each other a lot more in the space, which is really enjoyable.
And you're actually doing that on the set itself.
Which is fantastic. And it's so much bigger than I thought it was going to be. I really thought it was going to be this tiny little thing, but it's not at all. And, it's getting used to all the furniture and kind of making it your home for the next 3 months.
You've just been listening to Bishanya Vincent, who plays Prue in Eastern Engel's wartime drama Private Resistance. And before that, we heard Duke Ellington's extraordinary The A Train. Over at Parham, there is a striking photograph of the auxiliary unit from East Bergholt. It shows a group of men ranging in age from maybe 17 to 70, a reminder that the units were drawn from the men left at home. In Private Resistance, Diane is looking after her nephew, Wilf, played by Fred Lancaster. When I caught up with Fred, I started by asking just how old his character was.
He's terribly young, he's only 15. Which, given the fact that I'm 24, is quite a challenge.
That is quite a big challenge in terms of playing somebody 9 years your junior, absolutely. And a time and a piece set in the height of the Second World War.
A period piece, yeah. When I read it, first of all, my initial reaction was, you know, he's a child in the first half, and something obviously happens in the second half, but you don't want to sort of over egg the pudding in that sense. You don't want to come in and be too sort of, oh, gung ho chaps, jolly jolly good, you know, sort of just William. It's making that, how do you then translate that to, as you say, you know, a real person within a real situation. So we're discovering that in rehearsal.
And well, tell me a little bit more about the things that you're discovering about Wilf in terms of, I mean, I'm just interested to find out whether there are kind of connections in the way that he's grown up to the way that you grew up, or whether it's two completely different worlds.
Yeah, it's interesting. He lost his mother at the age of 10, and his father serves on a naval ship. So he's had a very different upbringing to me. My parents are very much still in my life. But I think, you know, similar in as much as he's an inquisitive, interested, excitable young guy who's always, you know, asking questions, and he's active. For the first half, it always seems as if I'm just rushing around for the whole thing.
And that, I guess he must be discovering, that must have been an extraordinary period to be a young person in terms of drawing... Initially, during World War II,
absolutely,
and then potentially as the play takes us into a scenario where the Germans have indeed invaded.
Yeah, it's almost impossible to imagine, but you have to go there. I think when we took the trip to Manningtree, that really brought it to life for me. You know, knowing the environment in which Wilf would, you know, be surrounded and things like schools and playing fields, and it gives it that detail that you can then, you know, make the imaginative leap and go, okay, and then do the research on top of that, you know, looking at scouts in the Second World War, looking at children. But I mean, the difference is, of course, is that he's a rural boy. He's not one of the city types that got evacuated. He is very much of the country, and so how that influences him, you know, throughout his life, I suppose. Was a different time. I've got a 15-year-old cousin who certainly isn't, you know, Wilf's character. But I do think we do, you know, we put on these fronts, these 21st century fronts, which I think, given the fact that technology didn't exist as much as it is now, or available to teenagers at least, it's completely